Harry said quietly. And let's go, Professor McGonagall. She walked over to the storeroom door. She wasn't quite able to stop herself from looking in, and saw the dried blood. The sheet covering the lower half, the upper body waxy and doll-like, and a glimpse of Hermione Granger's closed eyes. Something inside her began its weeping all over again. She closed the door. Her fingers moved upon her wand. Her mouth spoke words without thought, charms and wards to seal the room against entry. "Professor McGonagall," Harry said in a strange voice, as if by rote, "do you have the rock? The rock the headmaster gave me? I should transfigure it into a jewel again, since it did prove useful." Automatically, her eyes went to the ring on Harry's left pinky finger, noting the emptiness of the setting where the jewel should have been.
"I shall mention it to the headmaster,"
her tongue replied. "Is that a usual tactic, by the way?" Harry said, voice still odd. "Carrying something large, transfigured into something small, to use as a weapon. Or is that a usual exercise for transfiguration practice?" Distantly, she shook her head. "Well, let's go then."
"I have..."
Her voice stopped.
"I'm afraid I have something else which I must do now. Will you be all right on your own? And will you promise to go to the Great Hall directly and eat something, Mr. Potter?"
The boy promised, barring exceptional and unforeseen circumstances, a clause which she did not argue, and then walked out of the room. What lay ahead of her would be no easier, certainly, and might well be harder. Minerva walked to her office at a swift pace. Not slowly, for that would have been a discourtesy. Professor McGonagall opened the door to her office.
"Madam Granger,"
her voice said.
"Mr. Granger, I am so terribly sorry for..."
Chapter 92 Rolls, Part 3 There was nothing left to do. There was nothing left to plan. There was nothing left to think. Into that emptiness rose the new, worst memory. The boy who lived, unlike his best friend, trudged the long, echoing corridors toward the Great Hall. With all his energies of thought exhausted, his mind was starting to throw out thoughts like an image of Hermione walking beside him, and wordless concepts like, "That will never happen again," until another part yelled, "No!" and shouted it down with determination to bring her back, only that part's voice was getting tired, and the other part seemed tireless. Another part of his mind insisted on reviewing what he'd said to Professor McGonagall and Dad and Mum, even though he'd only been trying to get them out of there as quickly as possible and had been running on limited mental energy. As though somehow he could have done better by an act of his defective will. What would be left of his relationship with his parents now, Harry couldn't guess. He came finally to a junction where there waited an older boy in green-fringed black robes, silently reading a textbook, on the path that anyone would pick if they wanted to intercept someone going from the healer's chambers to the Great Hall. Harry was wearing the cloak of invisibility, of course. He'd put it on after leaving the office, rendering himself immune to almost all forms of magical detection. There was no point in making it easy for anyone trying to find him and kill him, and Harry was almost set to continue past without bothering to find out what was going on, when he recognized the Slytherin boy's face. Realization dawned on Harry then. Of course, one of the students who had stayed in school over the Easter holiday would naturally have been.
"You were waiting for me?"
Harry said out loud without removing the cloak. The Slytherin boy jerked back, hitting his head against the wall, his fifth-year charms textbook dropping from his hands, before he looked up with wide eyes.
"You're invisible, yes. Say what you mean to say."
Lesarth Lestrange scrambled to his feet, a position of attention, then blurted out,
"My lord, did I do the right thing? I thought you would not wish me to step forward before all those others, that they might suspect our connection. I thought, surely, if you wished my help, you would call on me."
It was amazing how many different ways there were to kill your best friend by being stupid.
"I..."
Lesarth hesitated, then said in a small voice,
"I was wrong, wasn't I? You acted exactly as you should have under the circumstances. It is I who was a fool." "I'm sorry, my lord," whispered Lesarth. "If you had come with me, would you have been able to kill the troll?"
It wasn't even the correct question. The correct question was whether Harry himself would have considered Lesarth as sufficient and flown out 60 seconds earlier. But still...
I'm not sure, my lord. I am not much welcome to dueling practices in Slytherin. I've not learned the gestures to the killing curse. Should I study those arts to better serve you, my lord?"
"I continue to insist that I am not your lord," Harry said.
"Yes, my lord." "Although,"
Harry said,
"and this is not any kind of order, just a remark, anyone ought to know how to defend themselves, especially you. I'm sure the defense professor would help you with that on general principles, if you asked."
Lesarth Lestrange bowed and said,
"Yes, my lord. I will follow your orders if I can, my lord."
Harry would have complained about being misunderstood, if he hadn't been understood perfectly. Lesarth left. Harry stared at the wall. He'd honestly thought that he'd already figured out all the different ways that he had been stupid after spending half a day thinking about it. Apparently, this had just been more overconfidence on his part.
"Do we understand what we did wrong?"
his Slytherin side said coldly.
"Yes,"
Harry thought.
"Your ethical qualms don't even make sense. You're not tricking Lesarth. You did exactly what Lesarth thinks you did. You wouldn't have to make excuses for why Lesarth was helping you. You could just say you were calling in the debt from rescuing him from bullies. There were 6 witnesses to that. Hermione died because you forgot about an extremely valuable resource, and you forgot about Lesarth because... why? Because having Lesarth Lestrange for a minion seemed sort of Dark Lordish,"
Hufflepuff said in a small mental voice.
"I mean, that decision was probably mostly me."
Harry Slytherin's side didn't answer that in words, just radiated contempt and flashed an image of Hermione's corpse.
"Stop it!"
Harry screamed internally.
"Next time," Slytherin said icily, "I suggest that we spend more time worrying about what is efficient and effective, and less time worrying about what seems sort of Dark Lordish." "Point made," Harry thought. "I will." "No, you won't," said Slytherin. "You'll come up with more rationalizations for your petty qualms. You'll start listening to me after your next friend dies."
Harry was starting to worry that he was going insane. The conversations he had with the voices in his head weren't usually like this. The boy who lived.
Pain.
Harry Veris trudged on alone.
Hurt.
Harry walked on through the silent corridors.
"How is Mr. Potter doing?" demanded Professor Quirrell.
There was a tension about the man. You could not quite call it concern, more like an ambusher measuring the time to strike. The Grangers had hardly left with Madame Pomfrey before the defense professor had knocked upon the door to her office and then entered without waiting for her to answer and spoken before she could say a word. Part of Minerva wondered distantly whether Harry Potter had picked up that habit from his defense professor, being unaware of others' pain when there was something else on his mind, or if it was only a childish flaw which this man had somehow failed to grow out of.
"Mr. Potter has ceased guarding Miss Granger's body," she said, putting some of the chill she felt into her voice.
She felt certain that the defense professor was not experiencing as much grief as she was. The man had spoken not a single word of Hermione Granger. For him to put demands on her.
"I believe he's gone down to dinner."
"I am not asking after the boy's physical state. Have you? Has he?"
Professor Quirrell made a sharp gesture as though to indicate a concept for which he had no words.
"Not particularly,"
she said. She was around 30 seconds away from ordering the defense professor out of her office. Professor Quirrell began to pace within the small confines of her office.
"Miss Granger was the only one whose worries he truly heeded. With her gone, all checks on the boy's recklessness are removed. I see it now. Who else is there? Mr. Longbottom? Mr. Potter does not pretend that they are peers. Flitwick? His goblin blood would only cry for vengeance. Mr. Malfoy, if he were returned, to what end? Snape? A walking disaster. Dumbledore? Pah! Events are already set for catastrophe. They must be steered along some course they would not naturally go. Who might Mr. Potter heed who would not ordinarily speak to him? Cedric Diggory has taught him, but what would Mr. Diggory say in advice? An unknown. Mr. Potter spent long in speech with Remus Lupin. To him I have paid little heed. Would Lupin know the words to speak, the acts which must be done, the sacrifice which must be made to change the boy's course?"
Professor Quirrell whirled on her.
"Did Remus Lupin comfort those in grief, or stay those moved to rash deeds during his time with the Order of the Phoenix?"
"It is not a poor thought,"
she said slowly.
"I believe that Mr. Lupin was often a voice of restraint to James Potter in his Hogwarts days."
"James Potter," said Professor Quirrell, his eyes narrowing. "The boy is not much like James Potter. Are you confident in the success of this plan?" "No, that is the wrong question. We are not limited to a single plan. Are you certain that this plan will be enough, that we need essay no others? Asked in such fashion, the question answers itself. The path leading to disaster must be averted along every possible point of intervention."
The defense professor had resumed pacing the confines of her office, reaching one wall, turning on his heel, pacing to the other.
"My apologies, Professor."
She did not bother keeping the sharpness from her voice.
"But I have quite reached my limits for the day. You may go."
"You!"
Professor Quirrell spun, and she found herself gazing directly into eyes of icy blue.
"You would be the first one I would think of after Miss Granger, to stay the boy from a folly. Have you already done your utmost? Of course you have not."
How dare he suggest that?
"If you have nothing more to say, Professor, then you will go."
"Has your confederacy deduced who I really am?"
The words were spoken with deceptive mildness.
"Yes, in fact. Now..."
Pure magic, pure power, crashed into the room like a flash of lightning, like a thunderclap echoing about her ears that deafened her other senses. The papers on her desk blown aside, not by any conjured wind, but by the sheer raw force of arcane might.
Then the power subsided, leaving only Hermione Granger's death certificates drifting down through the air to the floor.
"I am David Monroe, who fought Voldemort," the man said, still in mild tones. "Heed my words. The boy cannot be allowed to continue in this state of mind. He will become dangerous. It is possible that you have already done everything you can. Yet I find this a very rare event indeed, and more often said than done. I suspect rather that you have only done what you customarily do. I cannot truly comprehend what drives others to break their bounds, since I never had them. People remain surprisingly passive when faced with the prospect of death. Fear of public ridicule or losing one's livelihood is more likely to drive men to extremes and the breaking of their customary habits. On the other side of the war, the Dark Lord had excellent results from the Cruciatus Curse, judiciously used on marked servants who cannot escape punishment except by success, with no reasonable efforts excepted. Imagine their state of mind within yourself, and ask yourself whether you have truly done all that you can to wrench Harry Potter from his course."
"I am a Gryffindor, and not much given to being moved by fear,"
she snapped back.
"You will exercise courtesy within my office."
"I find fear an excellent motivation, and indeed it is fear that moves me now. You know who, for all his horror, still abided by certain boundaries. It is my professional judgment, speaking as a learned wizard almost on par with Dumbledore or he who must not be named, that the boy could join the ranks of those whose rituals are inscribed upon the tombstones of countries. This is not an idle worry, McGonagall. I have already heard words to produce the gravest apprehensions.
Are you mad? You think that Mr. Potter could... This is ridiculous. Mr. Potter cannot possibly...
A wordless image crossed her mind, of a patch of glass on a steel ball.
Mr. Potter would not do such a thing.
His deliberate choice is not required. Wizards rarely set out to invoke their own dooms. Mr. Potter may not strike you as malicious. Does he strike you as reckless once he is resolved upon a goal? I say again that I have specific reason for the gravest possible concerns.
Have you spoken to the headmaster of this?
She said slowly.
That would be worse than pointless. Dumbledore cannot reach the boy. At best, he is wise enough to know this and make things no worse. I lack the requisite frame of mind. You are the one who... But I see that you still look for others to save you.
The defense professor turned from her and strode to the door.
I think I shall consult with Severus Snape. The man may be a walking disaster, but he knows the fact, and he may possess a greater understanding of that boy's mood. As for you, madam, imagine yourself at the end of your life, knowing that Britain... But no, Britain is not your true country, is it? Imagine yourself at the end of your life as the darkness eats through the fading walls of Hogwarts, knowing that your students will die with you, remembering this day, and realizing that there was something else you could have done.
Chapter 93 Rolls, Part 4 Harry had walked into the Great Hall, looking around only once, grabbed enough calories to sustain himself, walked out, put on his cloak again, and found a small random corner in which to eat. Seeing the students at their tables...
Feeling revulsion when you look at other humans is not a good sign,
Hufflepuff said.
It's not reasonable to blame them for having not had your opportunities to learn what you've learned. Inaction in emergencies has nothing to do with people being selfish. Normalcy bias, like that plane crash in the... something, where a few people ran out and escaped, but most people just sat in their seats, not moving, while their plane was literally on fire. Look at how long you took to really start moving. It serves no useful purpose to hate, said Gryffindor. It's just going to damage your altruism. Try to figure out a training method you could use to prevent this from happening next time, said Ravenclaw. I'll go ahead and register the experimental prediction, said Slytherin. That will always observe exactly what would be predicted on the hypothesis that people cannot be saved, cannot be taught, and will never help us with anything important. Also, we need some way of keeping track of all the times I'm right.
Harry ignored the voices in his head and just ate slices of toast as fast as he could. It wasn't proper nutrition as a general policy, but one-time exceptions wouldn't hurt so long as he made them up the next day. In mid-bite, the blazing silver silhouette of a phoenix flew in from nowhere and said in the voice of a tired old man,
"Please remove your cloak, Harry. I have a letter to deliver to you."
Harry coughed for a bit, swallowed some toast which had gone down the wrong way, stood up, took off the invisibility cloak, said aloud,
"Tell Dumbledore I said fine,"
and then sat down and continued to eat his toast. The toast had all gone by the time Albus Dumbledore walked up to Harry's nook, carrying folded sheets of paper in his hand. Real paper, with lines, not wizard's parchment.
"Is that?"
Harry said.
"From your father, and from your mother," said the old wizard.
Wordlessly, Dumbledore handed over the folded sheets, and wordlessly, Harry accepted them. The old wizard hesitated, then said quietly,
"The defense professor has told me to restrain my counsel, and I thought the same thing myself when given time to think. I have always taken too long to learn the virtues of silence. But if I am mistaken, you need only say the word."
"You're not mistaken," Harry said.
He looked down at the folded, lined papers, feeling the sickness in his gut. That was how his body indicated a strong, pessimistic prediction. His parents wouldn't actually disown him, and there wasn't much they could do to him. Some part of himself was still afraid in a very visceral way of television privileges being taken away, no matter how little sense that made now. But he had stepped outside the role that parents would expect of children who, in their internal beliefs, were lower on the pecking order. It would be stupid to expect anything except complete indignant fury, all-out righteous rage, when you acted like that to someone who thought they were dominant over you.
"After you read it," the headmaster said, "I believe that you should come to the Great Hall at once, Harry. There is an announcement which you will wish to hear."
"I'm not interested in funerals."
"No, not that. Please, Harry, come as soon as you are done reading, and do so without your cloak. Will you?"
"Yes."
The old wizard left. Harry had to force himself to open up the letter. The important thing was keeping your vulnerable friends and relations out of harm's way. It might be a cliché, but so far as Harry could tell, the logic was valid. Damaged relationships could be repaired later. The first letter said, in script handwriting that required a careful focus for Harry to read,
"Son, no matter what you've read in books, keeping us out of harm's way is not as important as having adults who can help when you're in trouble. You decided, without giving us a word in edgewise, that we'd abandon you because of your dark side. The ghost of Shakespeare knows that I've seen things in this last year that were not dreamt of in my philosophy. Sometimes I wonder if your mum isn't just humouring me, and the authorities took you away when I started thinking you were a magic user. So I can't deny that it's possible you've managed to develop some, I'm not quite sure what to call it, but dark side seems premature if we don't know what's happening. Are you sure it's not a burgeoning telepathic talent, and you're just picking up on the minds of other wizards around you? Their thoughts might seem evil to a child who grew up in a saner civilization. These are ungrounded speculations, I admit, but you shouldn't jump to conclusions either. The two most important things I have to tell you are this. First, son, I have every confidence in your ability to stay on the light side of the Force, so long as you choose to. And I have every confidence that you will choose to. If there's some evil spirit whispering horrible suggestions in your ears, just ignore the suggestions. I do feel the need to emphasize that you should exercise special caution to ignore this evil spirit, even if it is suggesting what seem like wonderful creative ideas. And I hope I do not need to remind you about the incident with the science project, which would, I admit, make a deal more sense if you were struggling with demonic possession. The second thing I have to say is that you do not need to fear that Mum or I are going to abandon you because of your dark side. We may not have expected you to gain magical powers or develop an affinity for black magic, but we did expect you to become a teenager, which, if you think about it from your poor father's perspective, is already a sufficiently worrying prospect regarding a child who, by the age of 9, had been party to the summoning of a total of 5 fire engines. Children grow up. I won't lie to you and say that you'll feel as close to us at 20 as you do now, but your mum and I will feel just as close to you when you're old and grey and bothering the nursing home robots. Children always grow up and away from their parents, and the parents always follow them from behind, offering helpful advice. Children grow up, and their personalities change, and they do things that their parents wish they would not do, and they act disrespectfully toward their parents and have them hauled out of their magical schools, and the parents go on loving them anyway. It is nature's way. Though, in the event that you have not yet hit puberty and your teenage years are proportionately worse than this, we reserve the right to reconsider this sentiment. No matter what is happening, remember that we love you, and will always love you no matter what. I don't know if our love has any magical power under your rules, but if it does, don't hesitate to call on it. With all of this said, Harry, what you did there is not acceptable. I think you know that, and I also know that it is not the time to lecture you on it. But you must write and tell us what is happening. I can understand very well why you'd want us taken out of your school at once, and I know we can't force you to do anything. But please, Harry, be reasonable, and realize how terrified we must be. I would like to tell you that you are absolutely forbidden to mess around with any magic that the adults around you consider the least bit unsafe. But for all I know, the teachers at your school are giving everyone lessons in advanced necromancy every Monday. Please, please exercise as much caution as your situation permits, whatever your situation may be. Despite your very hurried summary, we don't have the slightest idea what's happening, and I hope that you will write us as much as you can. It is clear that you are, at least in some ways, growing up, and I will try not to act like the children's book parent who only makes things worse. Though, I hope you appreciate how hard this is, and your mum has said a number of frightening things to me about how wizardry stays secret, and how I might get you into trouble by making waves. I cannot tell you to avoid anything unsafe, because your school is unsafe, and your headmaster will not let you leave. I can't tell you that you shouldn't take responsibility for anything happening around you, because, for all I know, there are other children in trouble. But remember that it is not your moral responsibility to protect any adults. Their place is to protect you. And every good adult would agree with that. Please write and tell us more as soon as you can. Both of us are desperate to help. If there is anything at all that we can do, please let us know at once. There is nothing which can happen to us which would be worse than learning that something had happened to you. Love, Dad.
The last page said only,
"You promised me that you wouldn't let magic take you away from me. I didn't raise you to be a boy who would break a promise to his mum. You must come back safely because you promised. Love, Mum."
Slowly, Harry lowered the letters and began to walk towards the great hall. His hands were shaking. His whole body was shaking, and it seemed to be taking a very great deal of effort not to cry, which he knew wordlessly that he must not do. He hadn't cried through all of the day, and he wouldn't cry. Crying was the same as admitting defeat, and this wasn't over. So he wouldn't cry. The food served in the great hall that evening was plain that night. Toast and butter and jam. Water and orange juice, oatmeal and other simple fare without dessert. Some students had worn simple black robes without their house colours. Others had still worn theirs. It should have been cause for argument, but there was instead a quietness. The sound of people eating without talking. It took two sides to make a debate, and one of the sides, this night, was not much interested in debating. Deputy Headmistress Minerva McGonagall sat at the head table and did not eat. She should have. Perhaps she would in a short while, but she could not force herself to do it now. For a Gryffindor, there was only one path. It had taken Minerva only a short time to remember that, when, after the defense professor's urgings, her mind had stayed empty of clever plots to try. That was not a Gryffindor's way. Or perhaps she ought to say only that it was not her way. Albus did seem to try his hand at plotting. And yet, when she thought back on their history, there were no plots at the moment of crisis. No cleverness and games in the last resort. For Albus Dumbledore, as for her, the rule in extremis was to decide what was the right thing to do, and do it, no matter the cost to yourself. Even if it meant breaking your bounds, or changing your role, or letting go of your picture of yourself. That was the last resort of Gryffindor. Through a side entrance of the Great Hall, she saw Harry Potter quietly slip in. It was time. Professor Minerva McGonagall rose from her chair, straightened the worn point on her hat, walked slowly to the lectern before the head table. The sounds in the Great Hall, already muted, fell away entirely as all students turned to look at her.
"May now, you've all heard,"
she said, her voice not quite steady,
"that Hermione Granger is dead."
She didn't say those words aloud, since they had all heard.
"Somehow, a troll was infiltrated into the castle Hogwarts without a lamb from our ancient wards. Somehow, this troll succeeded in injuring a student without a lamb from the wards until the point of her death. Investigations are underway to determine how this has occurred. The Board of Governors is meeting to determine how Hogwarts will respond. In due time, justice shall be served. Meanwhile, there is another matter of justice which must be handled at once. George Weasley, Fred Weasley, please come forward to stand before us all."
The Weasley twins exchanged glances where they sat at the Gryffindor table, and then stood up and walked toward her. Slowly, reluctantly. And Minerva realized then that the Weasley twins thought that they were to be expelled. They honestly thought that she would expel them. That was what the picture of Professor McGonagall who lived in her head had wrought. The Weasley twins walked over to the lectern, looking up at her with faces that were frightened but resolute, and she felt something in her heart break a little further.
"I'm not going to expel you,"
she said, and was saddened further by the surprised look on their faces.
"Fred Weasley, George Weasley, turn and face your classmates. Let them see you."
Still looking surprised, the Weasley twins did so. She drew up all the steel in her heart and said what was right.
"I am ashamed," said Minerva McGonagall, "of the events of this day. I am ashamed that there were only two of you. Ashamed of what I have done to Gryffindor. Of all the houses, it should have been Gryffindor to help when Hermione Granger was in need, when Harry Potter called for the brave to aid him. It was true. A seventh year could have held back a mounting troll while searching for Miss Granger, and you should have believed that the head of House Gryffindor,"
her voice broke,
"would have believed in you if you disobeyed her to do what was right in events she had not foreseen. And the reason you did not believe this is that I have never shown it to you. I did not believe in you. I did not believe in the virtues of Gryffindor itself. I tried to stamp out your defiance instead of training your courage to wisdom. Whatever the sorting hat saw in me that led it to place me in Gryffindor, I have betrayed it. I have offered my resignation to the headmaster as deputy headmistress and is the head of House Gryffindor."
There were cries of shock and dismay, and not only from the Gryffindor table, as Harry's heart froze within his chest. Harry needed to run forward, say something. He hadn't meant for this to... Minerva took another breath and continued.
"However, the headmaster has declined to accept my resignation,"
she said.
"So, I will continue to serve and try to undo what I have wrought. Somehow, I must find a way to teach my students how to do what is right, not what is safe, not what is easy, not what we are told to do. If all I can teach you is to turn in your essays on time, there might as well not be a House Gryffindor. This road will be more difficult for me, and maybe for all of us. But I know that before I was only taking the easy path.
She stepped down from the lectern, moved down to where the Weasley twins stood.
"Fred Weasley, George Weasley," she said. "The two of you have not always done what is right. The path of wisdom does not lie in flagrant and needless defiance of authority. And yet today you proved to be the last of our house to survive my mistakes. Because it was the right thing to do, you defied a threat of expulsion and risked your lives to face a mountain troll. For your astounding courage that honours your house to have you, I award each of you 200 points for Gryffindor."
Again, the look of shock on their faces. Again, the pain like a knife through her heart. She turned to face the other students.
"I will not award any points to Ravenclaw," she said. "I suspect that Mr. Potter would not want them. If I am wrong, he may correct me and take as many house points as he pleases. But, for whatever it's worth, Mr. Potter, I am..."
Her voice faltered.
"I am sorry."
"Stop!"
Harry screamed, and then again,
"Stop!"
the word sticking in his throat.
"You don't have to, Professor."
Something inside him was twisting, threatening to split him open, like a giant's hand wrenching at him to tear him in half.
"And you shouldn't forget Susan Bones and Ron Weasley. They also helped. They should get house points too."
"Miss Bones and the young Weasley," said Professor McGonagall. "Rubius said nothing of that. What did they do?"
"Miss Bones tried to stun Mr. Hagrid when he tried to stop me, and Mr. Weasley shot Neville when Neville tried to stop me. They should both get points, and so should Neville."
Harry hadn't thought to imagine it before, the way Neville must be feeling now, but the instant he'd thought, he knew.
"Because Neville tried to do something, even if it wasn't the right thing. Doing what's right is the second lesson. You can start practicing that after you learn to do anything at all."
10 points to Hufflepuff, Miss Bones,"
Professor McGonagall said, her voice breaking in the middle.
10 points to Gryffindor, Ron Weasley. Your family has done itself exceedingly proud this day. And 10 points to Hufflepuff for Neville Longbottom, for standing up to Mr. Potter and doing what he thought was right."
"You shouldn't,"
screamed a young voice from the Hufflepuff table, followed by a single choking sound. Harry looked there, and then quickly looked back at Professor McGonagall and said, as steadily as he could,
"Neville's right, actually. You can't award literally 0 points for the part where you get the action correct. That sends the wrong message, too. But he was halfway there, so it could be 5 points instead."
Professor McGonagall looked, for a moment, like she couldn't think of what to say. But then her eyes went to Neville's place at the table, and she said,
"As you wish, Mr. Potter. What is it, Miss Bones?"
Harry looked and saw that Susan Bones had stepped forward, wiping at her own eyes, and the Hufflepuff girl said,
"Actually, Professor McGonagall, General Potter didn't see it, but Captain Weasley and I weren't the only ones who tried to get in Mr. Hagrid's way after he ran out. Before some of the older students stopped us, but we managed to slow Mr. Hagrid down a minute so General Potter could get away.
"You've got to give them points too," said Ron Weasley from the Gryffindor table, "or I won't take any."
"Who else?"
said Professor McGonagall, her voice a bit unsteady. Seven other children stood up.
"What was that our Slytherin side was saying about predicting nothing would ever work?"
said Hufflepuff. Something in Harry cracked, so that he had to exert all his force to hold himself together. When all had been said and all had been done, Minerva went to where Harry Potter stood. Though it was not her greatest skill, she cast a ward about them to blur vision and muffled sounds with another thought.
"You didn't have to," said Harry Potter. "You shouldn't have said..."
He sounded like he was choking.
"Professor, everything I said to you was hurtful and hateful and wrong."
"I already knew that, Harry,"
she said.
"Even so, I wished to do better."
There was a feeling of lightness in her chest, much as one might experience after stepping off a cliff, when your legs no longer had to hold your body upright. She wasn't sure she could do this. She didn't know the way, and yet for the first time it seemed possible that Hogwarts wouldn't become a sad ghost of its former self when she became its headmistress. Harry stared at her, then made an odd noise that sounded like it had been forced from his throat, and covered his face in his hands. So she knelt down and hugged him. It might go wrong, but it might also go right, and she would not let that uncertainty stop her. It was time she began to learn a Gryffindor's courage, so that she could teach it in turn.
"I had a sister once,"
she whispered. Just that, nothing more.
"Just to make sure,"
said some part of Harry, while the rest of him sobbed into Professor McGonagall's arms.
"This doesn't mean we've accepted Hermione's death, right?"
"No!"
said all the rest of him, every part of his mind in unanimous agreement. Warmth and cold, and a hidden place of steel.
"Never, ever, forever."
And an ancient wizard, to whom that ward meant nothing, gazed upon them both, the witch and the weeping young wizard. Albus Dumbledore was smiling with a strange, sad look in his eyes, like someone who had taken one more step toward a foreseen destination. The defense professor watched them both, the woman and the crying boy. His eyes were very cold and very calculating. He did not think that this would be enough. It wasn't until the next morning that it was discovered that Hermione Granger's body was missing. Chapter 94 Rolls, Part 5.
The First Meeting.
At 6:07 a.m. on April 17th, 1992, the sun was just rising above the horizon as seen from the castle Hogwarts, filtering in through dawn curtains in the Ravenclaw First Year's Boys' Dorm to provide a gentle light. Red-orange for dawn, and little changed by the white fabric covering the windows, not yet waking boys more accustomed to winter's schedule. In one bed among many, Harry Potter slept the sleep of the just exhausted. Quietly, the door opened. Quietly, a figure walked across the floor. That figure came to Harry Potter's bed. The figure laid a hand on the shoulder of the sleeping boy, who started and shrieked. No others heard.
"Mr. Potter,"
the small man squeaked.
"The headmaster has requested your presence immediately."
Slowly, the boy sat up in bed, his hands momentarily fiddling beneath the covers. He'd expected to feel much worse, waking up this morning. It felt wrong that his brain functioned now, that his thoughts still moved, that he wasn't incapacitated with weeping for at least a week. The boy knew that it wouldn't have been an adaptive response for brains to evolve to do that. His dark side certainly would not do that. Even so, it still felt wrong to be alive and lucid this morning. But his resolution to revive Hermione Granger felt sufficient. Like he was already doing the right thing, bent on the right path, and she would be brought back, and that was all there was to it. Grief would have been giving up. There was nothing left to decide. No ambiguity, no conflict to tear at him, and no need to remember what he had seen.
"I'll get dressed," Harry said.
Professor Flitwick looked rather reluctant, but said in his high voice,
"The headmaster specified you were to be brought to his office directly and without pause, Mr. Potter. I'm sorry."
Less than a minute later, Professor Flitwick had sent him straight to the headmaster's office through the Hogwarts internal flue. Harry found himself, still in his pyjamas, facing Albus Dumbledore. The deputy headmistress was also sitting in another chair, and the potions master lurked nearby amid the weird devices, caught in a gaping yawn just as Harry had entered through the fireplace.
"Harry," the headmaster said without preamble, "before I say what I must say next, I tell you that Hermione Granger did truly die. The wards recorded it and informed me. The very stone spoke that a witch had died. I tested her body where it lay, and those were Hermione Granger's true mortal remains, not any doll or likeness. There is no way known to wizardry by which death may be undone. All this being said, Hermione Granger's remains are now missing from the storeroom where they were placed, and where you guarded them. Did you take them, Harry Potter?"
"No," Harry said, narrowing his eyes. A glance showed him that Severus was watching him intently. Dumbledore's gaze was also keen, though not unfriendly.
"Is Hermione Granger's body in your possession?"
"No."
"Do you know where it is?"
"No."
"Do you know who took it?"
"No,"
Harry said, then hesitated.
"Besides the obvious probabilistic speculations, which are not based upon any specific knowledge of mine."
The old wizard nodded.
"Do you know why it was taken?"
"No, besides the obvious speculations, etc."
What would those be?
If the enemy can notice you running off to consult the Weasley twins during class after Hermione was arrested, and find out about that magic map you said was stolen, then the enemy can wonder why I was guarding Hermione Granger's body. My turn. Did you arrange for Hermione's death in hopes of getting the money back from Lucius?
What?
Said Professor McGonagall.
No,
said the old wizard. Did you know or suspect that Hermione Granger would die?
I did not know. As for suspicions, I placed her in the most strongly defended position I could against Voldemort. I did not will her death, nor allow it, nor plan to benefit from it, Harry Potter. Now, show me your pouch.
It's in my trunk, Harry began.
Severus,
said the old wizard, and the potions master moved forward.
Check his trunk as well, every compartment.
My trunk has wards. Severus Snape grinned mirthlessly and strode into the green flame. Dumbledore took out his long, dark grey wand and began to wave it close around Harry's hair, looking like a muggle using a metal detector. Before he had reached as far as Harry's neck, Dumbledore stopped.
"The gem upon your ring," Dumbledore said. "It is no longer a clear diamond. It is brown, the colour of Hermione Granger's eyes, and the colour of her hair."
A sudden tension filled the room.
"That's my father's rock," Harry said. "Transfigured the same as before, I just did it to remember Hermione."
"I must be sure. Take off that ring, Harry, and place it upon my desk."
Slowly, Harry did so, removing the gem and setting the ring off to the other side of the desk. Dumbledore pointed his wand at the gem and a large, undistinguished grey rock jumped into the air from the force of its sudden expansion, hit some invisible barrier in the air above, and then fell down with a loud crack upon the headmaster's desk.
"There's another half hour of work for me transfiguring it again," Harry said evenly.
Dumbledore resumed his examination. Harry had to remove his left shoe and take off the toe ring that was his emergency portkey if someone kidnapped him and took him outside the wards of Hogwarts, and didn't put up anti-apparition, anti-portkey, anti-phoenix, and anti-time-looping wards, which Severus had warned Harry that the Inner Circle Death Eaters would certainly do. It was verified that the magic radiating from the toe ring was indeed the magic of a portkey, and not the magic of a transfiguration. The rest of Harry was deemed clear. Not long after, the potions master returned, bearing Harry's pouch and several other magical things which had been in Harry's trunk, which the headmaster also examined one by one, even to all the items remaining within the healer's kit.
"Can I go now?"
Harry said when it was all done, putting as much cold as he could into his voice. He took up his pouch and began the process of feeding the grey rock into it. The empty ring went back on his finger. The old wizard breathed out, slipping his wand back into his sleeve.
"I am sorry," he said. "I had to know. Harry, the Dark Lord has taken Hermione Granger's remains, it seems. I cannot think of anything he would gain thereby, except to send her corpse against you as an inverus. Severus shall give you certain potions to keep about your person. Be warned now. and be prepared for when you must do what must be done.
Will the Inferas have Hermione's mind?
No.
Then it's not her. Can I go, at least to change out of my pyjamas?
There is other news, but I shall be brief. The wards of Hogwarts record that no foreign creature has entered, and that it was the defense professor who killed Hermione Granger.
Harry said.
Thought one. But I saw the troll kill Hermione.
Thought two.
Professor Quirrell memory-charmed me and set up the scene that Dumbledore saw when he arrived.
Thought three.
Professor Quirrell can't do that. His magic can't touch mine. I saw that in Azkaban.
Thought four.
Can I trust those memories?
Thought five.
There was clearly some sort of debacle at Azkaban. We wouldn't have needed a rocket if Professor Quirrell hadn't fallen unconscious. And why'd he been unconscious if not...
Thought six.
Did I ever actually go to Azkaban at all?
Thought seven.
I clearly practiced controlling Dementors at some point before I scared that Dementor in the Wizengamot. And that was in the newspapers.
Thought eight.
Am I actually remembering the newspapers?
Harry said again.
That spell seriously ought to be unforgivable. You think Professor Quirrell could have memory-charmed?
No. I went back through time and placed certain instruments to record Hermione's last battle, which I could not quite bear to watch in my own person.
The old wizard looked very grim indeed.
Your guess was right, Harry Potter. Voldemort sabotaged everything we gave Hermione to protect her. Her broomstick lay dead in her hands. Her invisibility cloak did not conceal her. The troll walked in the sunlight unharmed. It was no stray creature, but a weapon pure and aimed. And it was indeed the troll who killed her, with strength alone, so that my wards and webs to detect hostile magics went for naught. The defense professor never crossed her path.
Harry swallowed, shut his eyes, and thought.
So, this was an attempted frame on Professor Quirrell, somehow. It does seem to be the enemy's modus operandi. Troll eats Hermione Granger. Check the wards. Oh, look, actually, the defense professor did it. Same as last year. No, that can't be right.
Why not, Mr. Potter? Said the potions master. It seems obvious enough to me.
That's the problem. The enemy is smart.
Slowly the fog of sleep was drifting out of Harry's mind, and after a full night's sleep his brain could see things which hadn't been obvious the day before. Under standard literary convention, the enemy wasn't supposed to look over what you'd done, sabotage the magic items you'd handed out, and then send out a troll rendered undetectable by some means the heroes couldn't figure out even after the fact, so that you might as well have not defended yourself at all. In a book, the point of view usually stayed on the main characters. Having the enemy just bypass all the protagonist's work as a result of planning and actions taken out of literary sight would be a diabolus ex machina, and dramatically unsatisfying. But, in real life, the enemy would think that they were the main character, and they would also be clever, and think things through in advance, even if you didn't see them do it. That was why everything about this felt so disjointed, with parts unexplained and seemingly inexplicable. How had Lucius felt when Harry had threatened Dumbledore with breaking Azkaban? How had the auras above Azkaban felt seeing the broomstick rise up on a torch of fire?
The enemy is smart.
The enemy knew perfectly well that you'd turn back time to check what really happened to Hermione, especially since the troll getting into Hogwarts at all tells us that somebody can fool the wards.
Harry shut his eyes, thinking harder, trying to put himself into the enemy's shoes. Why would he, or his dark side, have done something like...
We're meant to conclude that the enemy has control of what the wards tell us, but that's actually something the enemy can only do with difficulty or under special conditions. They're trying to create a false appearance of omnipotence.
Like I would.
Later, hypothetically, the wards show Professor Sinestra killing someone. We think the wards are just being fooled again, but really... Professor Sinestra was legitimized, and she did do it.
Unless that is precisely what the Dark Lord expects us to think, said Severus Snape, his brow furrowed in concentration. In which case, he does have control of the wards, and Professor Sinestra will be innocent.
Does the Dark Lord really use plots with that many levels of meta?
Yes,
said Dumbledore and Severus. Harry nodded distantly.
Then this could be a setup to either make us think the wards are telling the truth when they're lying, or a setup to make us think the wards are lying when they're telling the truth, depending on what level the enemy expects us to reason at. But if the enemy is planning to make us trust the wards, we would have trusted the wards anyway if we'd been given no reason to distrust them, so there's no need to go to all the work of framing Professor Quirrell in a way that we would realize we were intended to discover, just to trick us into going meta.
Not so, said Dumbledore. If Voldemort has not fully mastered the wards, then the wards had to believe that some professor's hand was at work, else they would have cried out at Miss Granger's injury, and not only upon her death.
Harry reached up a hand and rubbed at his brow, just beneath his hair.
Okay, serious question. If the enemy is that smart, why the heck am I still alive? Is it seriously that hard to poison someone? Are there charms and potions and bezoars which can cure me of literally anything that could be slipped into my breakfast? Would the wards record it? Trace the magic of the murderer? Could my scar contain the fragment of soul that's keeping the Dark Lord anchored to the world so he doesn't want to kill me? Instead, he's trying to drive off all my friends to weaken my spirit so he can take over my body. It'd explain the parcel mouth thing. The sorting hat might not be able to detect a lich phylactery thing. Obvious problem one. The Dark Lord is supposed to have made his lich phylactery thingy in 1943 by killing... what's-her-name, and framing Mr. Hagrid. Obvious problem, too. There's no such thing as souls. Though Dumbledore also thought that my blood was a key ingredient in a ritual to restore the Dark Lord's full strength, which would require keeping me alive until then. Now there's a cheery thought.
Well,
Harry said,
I'm sure of one thing.
And that is...
Neville needs to be taken out of Hogwarts now. He's the obvious next target, and no first-year student can survive this level of offense.
We're lucky Neville wasn't assassinated yesterday evening. The enemy doesn't have to wait until we're finished mourning to make their next move.
Why didn't the enemy strike while we were distracted?
Dumbledore exchanged glances with Severus, and then with the suddenly tight expression of Professor McGonagall.
Harry, said the old wizard, if you send all your friends away yourself, that is just the same as if Voldemort...
I will be fine. I can do without Neville for a couple of extra months. It's not like you are planning to make my friends stay here over the summer, and that it's just plain not sufficient justification to let him get killed. Professor McGonagall.
I quite agree,
said the Scottish witch. She frowned.
I extremely agree. I agree to the point where I'm having some trouble figuring out how to express this, Albus.
To the point where you're going to haul him out there yourself, regardless of what anyone else says, because it's no excuse to say you were only following orders if Neville gets killed,
Harry said. Professor McGonagall closed her eyes briefly.
Yes, but surely there ought to be some way to be responsible without threats of unilateral action.
The headmaster sighed.
No need. Go, Minerva.
Right,
the potions master said, just as Professor McGonagall, moving rather swiftly, was taking a pinch of green dust from the flu vase.
We should not call attention to the boy, as the headmaster called attention to the Weasley twins. It would be wiser, I think, if Mr. Longbottom's grandmother took him from Hogwarts. Let him stay in his common room for now. The Dark Lord does not seem able to act so openly.
There was another long exchange of glances among the four, and finally Harry nodded, followed by Professor McGonagall.
In that case, said Harry, I'm sure of one other thing.
And that is, said Dumbledore,
I very much need to visit the washroom, and I would also like to change out of these pajamas. By the way, Harry said, as he and the headmaster emerged from Flu into the empty office of the Ravenclaw head of house. One last quick question I wanted to ask just you. That sword the Weasley twins pulled out of the Sorting Hat, that was the sword of Gryffindor, wasn't it?
The old wizard turned, face neutral.
What makes you think that, Harry?
The Sorting Hat yelled, Gryffindor, just before handing it out. The sword had a ruby pommel and gold letters on the blade, and the Latin script said nothing better. Just a hunch.
Nihil supernum, said the old wizard. That is not quite what it means.
Harry nodded.
Mm-hmm. What did you do with it?
I retrieved it from where it fell and placed it in a secure place,
the old wizard said. He gave Harry a stern look.
I hope you're not greedy for it yourself, young Ravenclaw.
Not at all. Just wanted to make sure you're not keeping it permanently from its rightful wielders. So, the Weasley twins are the heir of Gryffindor, then?
The heir of Gryffindor?
Dumbledore said, looking surprised. Then the old wizard smiled, blue eyes twinkling brightly.
Ah, Harry, Salazar Slytherin may have built a chamber of secrets into Hogwarts, but Godric Gryffindor was not much given to such extravagances. We have seen only that Godric left his sword to the defense of Hogwarts. If a worthy student ever faced a foe they could not defeat alone.
That's not the same thing as saying no. Don't think I didn't notice that you didn't actually say no.
I did not live in those years, Harry. I do not know all that Godric Gryffindor may, or may not, have done.
Do you, in fact, assign greater than 50% subjective probability that there is something like an heir of Gryffindor, and one or both Weasley twins are it? Yes or no? Evasion means yes. You're not going to succeed in distracting me, no matter how much I have to go to the bathroom.
The old wizard sighed.
Yes, Fred and George Weasley are the heir of Gryffindor. I beg you not to speak of it to them. Not yet.
Harry nodded and turned to go.
I'm surprised, Harry said. I read a little about Godric Gryffindor's historical life. The Weasley twins are... well, they're awesome in various ways, but they don't seem much like the Godric in the history books.
Only a man exceedingly proud and vain,
Dumbledore said quietly as he turned back to the flue, roaring up again with green flames,
would believe that his heir should be like himself, rather than like who he wished that he could be.
The headmaster stepped into the green fire and was gone.
The second meeting in a small cubby off the Hufflepuff common room.
Neville Longbottom's face was drawn up in anguish as he spoke with no one to hear, to the empty air.
Seriously,
the empty air said back to him,
I'm wearing an invisibility cloak with extra anti-detection charms just to walk through the hallways because I don't want to be killed. My parents would have me out of Hogwarts in an instant if the headmaster allowed it. Neville, your getting the heck out of Hogwarts is common sense. It has nothing to do with... betrayed you, General,
Neville said, his voice around as hollow as any normal 11-year-old boy could reasonably manage.
I didn't even do it the chaotic way. I conformed to authority and tried to make you conform to authority too. What's that you always say about how in the Chaos Legion a soldier who can obey orders is useless? Neville,
the empty air said firmly. The pressure of two hands beneath thin cloth came firmly to bear on Neville's shoulders, and the voice moved closer to him.
You weren't blindly obeying authority. You were trying to protect me. It's true that in this chaotic world, soldiers who can only follow rules and regulations are worthless. However, soldiers who follow rules for the sake of protecting their friends are... slightly better than worthless,
Neville said bitterly.
Significantly better than worthless. Neville, you made an error of judgment. It cost me around 6 seconds. Now, it could be that Hermione's injuries were just barely fatal, but even then, I don't think 6 seconds was actually enough time for the troll to take an extra bite of Hermione. In the counterfactual world where you didn't step in front of me, Hermione still died. Now, I could stand here listing out the first dozen ways that Hermione could be alive if I hadn't been stupid. You ran right after her. I'm the one who tried to stop you. It's my fault, if it's anyone's,
Neville said bitterly. The empty air went silent at this for a while.
Wow,
the empty air finally said.
"Well, that puts a pretty different perspective on things, I have to say. I'm going to remember this the next time I feel an impulse to blame myself for something. Neville, the term in the literature for this is egocentric bias. It means that you experience everything about your own life, but you don't get to experience everything else that happens to the world. There was way, way more going on than you running in front of me. You're going to spend weeks remembering that thing you did there for 6 seconds, I can tell. But nobody else is going to bother thinking about it. Other people spend a lot less time thinking about your past mistakes than you do, just because you're not the center of their worlds. I guarantee you that nobody except you has even considered blaming Neville Longbottom for what happened to Hermione. Not for a fraction of a second. You are being, if you'll pardon the phrase, a silly dilly. Now shut up and say goodbye.
I don't want to say goodbye, Neville said.
His voice was trembling, but he managed not to cry.
I want to stay here and fight with you against... against whatever's happening.
The empty air moved closer to him and embraced him in a hug, and Harry Potter's voice whispered,
"Tough luck."
Chapter 95 Rolls, Part 6
The third meeting, 10:31 a.m., April 17th, 1992.
Spring had begun, the late morning air still crisp with the leavings of winter. Daffodils had bloomed amid the sprouting grass of the forest, the gentle yellow petals with their golden hearts dangling limply from their dead, greyed stems. Wounded or killed by some of the sudden frosts that you often saw in April. In the Forbidden Forest, there would be stranger life-forms, centaurs and unicorns at least, and Harry had heard allegations of werewolves, though from what Harry had read of real-life werewolves, that didn't make the slightest bit of sense. Harry didn't venture anywhere near the border of the Forbidden Forest, since there was no reason to take the risk. He walked invisibly among the more ordinary life-forms of the Permitted Woods, wand in hand, a broomstick strapped to his back for easier access, just in case. He was not actually afraid. Harry thought it odd that he didn't feel afraid. The state of constant vigilance, readiness for fight or flight, failed to feel burdensome or even abnormal. On the edges of the Permitted Woods, Harry walked, his feet never straying near the beaten path where he might be more easily found, never leaving sight of Hogwarts's windows. Harry had set the alarm upon his mechanical watch to tell him when it was lunchtime, since he couldn't actually look at his wrist, being invisible and all that. It raised the question of how his eyeglasses worked while he was wearing the cloak. For that matter, the law of the excluded middle seemed to imply that either the rhodopsin complexes in his retina were absorbing photons and transducing them to neural spikes, or, alternatively, those photons were going straight through his body and out the other side. But not both. It really did seem increasingly likely that invisibility cloaks let you see outward while being invisible yourself because, on some fundamental level, that was how the caster had not wanted, but implicitly believed that invisibility should work. Whereupon, you had to wonder whether anyone had tried confunding or legitimizing someone into implicitly and matter-of-factly believing that fixus everythingus ought to be an easy first-year charm, and then trying to invent it. Or maybe finding a worthy Muggle-born in a country that didn't identify Muggle-born children, and then tell them some extensive lies, fake up a surrounding story and corresponding evidence, so that, from the very beginning, they'd have a different idea of what magic could do. Though, apparently, they'd still have to learn a number of previous charms before they became capable of inventing their own. It might not work. Surely, there'd been some organically insane wizards who truly believed in their own possibility of godhood, and yet had failed to become god. But even the insane had probably believed the ascension spell ought to be some grandiose dramatic ritual, and not something you did with a carefully composed twitch of your wand and the incantation, "Become us, goddess." Harry was already pretty sure it wouldn't be that easy. But then the question was, why not? What pattern had his brain learned? Could the reason be predicted in advance? A slight fringe of apprehension crept through Harry then, a tinge of worry as he contemplated this question. The nameless concern sharpened, grew greater.
"Professor Quirrell?"
"Mr. Potter," a soft voice called from behind him. Harry spun, his hand going to the time-turner beneath his cloak. Again, the principle of being ready to flee upon an instant's notice felt only ordinary. Slowly, palms empty and turned outward, Professor Quirrell was walking towards him within the forest outskirts, coming from the general direction of the Hogwarts castle.
"Mr. Potter," Professor Quirrell said again.